All right, it's that time again for another exciting and enthralling and thought-provoking episode of our podcast. This is Nick Deolius. I'm coming at you from the far middle, and I hope you've been a constant listener and have been listening along through each of our individual episodes as we've walked through the individual subjects and themes and chapters of my upcoming book, The Leech. This is episode number 14 of the Far Middle Podcast, and it is a milestone episode because this is, unfortunately, in some ways, I suppose, a closing episode for covering the topics in the book, The Leech, as I said, that's upcoming and will be published here in hard copy format at the beginning of 2022, January 2022. But that it is also available now with a chapter-by-chapter release that accompanied these podcasts of the Far Middle over the past couple of months on my website at nickdeolius.com. So if you want to give it a read sooner rather than later, I welcome you to go to nickdeolius.com and click under the Leech tab. And then if you want something in hard copy form that you want to be able to hold and read, that will be coming to you sooner than you know it. So for sure, this episode is a milestone, particularly when it comes to the subject of the book, The Leech. And ironically, I want to kick off this podcast raising a subject that I first discussed way back in episode number one, when we were just introducing the themes and concepts in the book. And that is the subject of motivation. What motivated me to write this book? I'm going to start the conversation on the subject of motivation, quoting someone that I am not a fan of and that I am ideologically, philosophically opposed to. The individual is Vladimir Lenin. Nevertheless, he did have a quote that I think sums up life pretty well, and to a large extent for many of us, if not most of us. He said, "There are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen." Now, how true is that? Both, again, from an individual's journey through life, as well as with respect to big trends and seismic shifts that we see across economies and the human condition over time. When I was writing the book and spending the couple of years that it took to get it into the form that you see today, there were indeed seismic shifts and events that were unfolding where within weeks, decades were happening. And that helped maybe not serve as the wellspring of the motivation to write the book, but it certainly, at a minimum, served as a catalyst to spur me along to not just write the book, but to conclude it in a way where I'd be able to sit here and talk about it with you today. The events that really catalyzed or turbocharged my motivation to write the book were the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections, both everything that led up to those events coming up to elections and then everything that happened afterward. So we'll have more thoughts that I'll offer up here on that and those series of events in a couple of minutes. Before I do that, I would like to spend a couple of minutes to go back to motivation and discuss it in the context of an individual that did a better job than anyone in the history of literature or writing to sum up what motivates a writer. And that individual is, contrary to Lenin, who is not a hero of mine, someone that I do consider to be a hero or certainly I'm an admirer of, and that is George Orwell. If you've been a constant listener of this podcast or you read the book, The Leech, you know by now that I'm always looking for an opportunity to quote or draw lines to his writing. Just a genius writer. But he wrote an essay regarding motivation and motivation particularly for writers and authors. And the essay was titled Why I Write. I'd encourage you to give it a look online if you get a chance. But what a brilliant synopsis of four big motivations that authors find that spur them to go through a very painful process of putting together something like a book. The genius of Orwell is in just his writing, as epic and overwhelming as that is. But on top of it, his ability to just have the resonance and having him be relevant in modern day 2021, when he wrote much of his works in the 30s and in the 40s, just an unbelievable resiliency that survived the times. It's almost as if the guy had a crystal ball. Babe Ruth, just to use an analogy we're familiar with, he became famous for what? For calling his home run shot in a game and in the moment. But Orwell, when you look at what he did, he called society shot back in the 30s and the 40s. that is more true than ever today. So the Babe, he called a pitch and a play in the moment. Orwell, he called a society and the flaws of the human condition decades into the future. How impressive is that? And on top of it, he puts out this essay, Why I Write, out there for all of us, that really places in context not just his works, but what was driving him when he created those works. And that essay, Why I Write, is one that every author or budding author should give a read to, because it does really help crystallize those motivations, which I think can serve as a very effective catalyst to get things created and published for the wider world to digest and consider. He pointed out something really interesting, that you can't understand a writer's true motivations without understanding the writer's early development. The early development of the writer is an input and impacts the work product on the back end of the book itself. That's certainly true with myself and my motivation for writing The Leech. We talked in earlier podcasts about my background and how my family was middle class, working class, blue collar, immigrant class, all of those things, depending on which generation you tied it to. But that all tied to what was Western Pennsylvania and the Pittsburgh region and all the great things that came with it. And some of the great things that came with it, I believe, were one, respect, and particularly respect for the achiever and the doer. So the can-do attitude and the person that gets out there and accomplishes or achieves and does, that's to be respected. And another good thing that came with it was disdain for the looter that is looking to loot value of others and appropriate the value of others. That just was wired within the DNA of most people in Western Pennsylvania, and working class, and blue collar, and middle class, and immigrant class, all of the above. And Orwell also made mention of a really interesting term. The term he used was the emotional attitude that someone never escapes from. That this emotional attitude that you don't escape from, that is another motivator for why authors write. And I think that's not just true for me, but I think that applies to people beyond just individuals writing books or authors. We all have that emotional attitude that we've never fully escaped from, that traces back to our upbringing and development years. And I think, too, he did a great job pointing out that the timing matters. This goes back to that Lenin quote. He pointed out that the age we live in is going to shape the emotional attitude that you're not going to be able to escape from, which will drive your views and your motivations. And this is an age where it has become heightened for many of us, looking at the past number of years. I'm going to quote another great individual that I'm an admirer of, Billy Joel, the music artist. And he's got a classic song, old Billy Joel, not his newer stuff. And the title of the song is Summer Highland Falls. He's got a line in there that sums up what Orwell was talking about, which was, they say these are not the best of times, but they're the only times I've ever known. That is saying what Orwell is saying, just in a different way, which is the times that you live in define that emotional attitude that you're going to carry. And that emotional attitude that you've developed early on in your development is going to stay with you to a large extent throughout your entire life. Now, back to those four motivations that Orwell enumerated in his essay, Why I Write. The first one is the most straightforward, ego. Ego gets a bad rap in society today, I think. I think that's a good thing to have an ego, a healthy ego. And hey, I'm guilty as charged. That ego helped drive me to achieve things academically and in the business world, personal goals. It was certainly a player in writing the book, The Leech. The second motivation that Orwell listed was aesthetic enthusiasm. Now, what in the world is that? He called it a desire to share an experience which one feels is valuable and ought not to be missed. Okay, now that makes more sense to me. And that is the case for me here as well. I wanted people to know two things when I wrote the book. First is that my journey, what it was, what made it a positive one. So we protect all those things that made it possible and allow them to grow. That's important so that others can pursue a similar journey. The second thing I wanted to point out to people to know is that what I see today out there that is holding back others from sharing a similar journey, and that the leech is driving. And I'm trying to motivate individuals and people to try to arrest and deter what the leech is trying to achieve. because that will stop others from realizing their potential and embarking on a similar and positive journey of what they want to achieve or what they want to accomplish in their life and career. The third motivation that Orwell laid out was historical impulse. What is historical impulse? It's the desire to see things as they are and to find out the true facts and store them up for the use of posterity. So what's really going on? Let's accumulate that knowledge and that discussion, and then let's use it for future use and for posterity purposes because we can benefit from that. Wow, that is, hugely applicable to me when writing the book. I view this as the let's call it like it is attitude. And coupling that let's call it like it is with the feeling that dots have been connected in a way that most did not see maybe individually, but once you connect them, it's obvious. The picture becomes much clearer, which when you think about the book, The Legion, our prior podcasts, many of the individual episodes and chapters were individual dots that we explored deeply and discussed deeply, did deep dives on. But then throughout the course of the book and the underlying theme of things like the Leech Way, connecting those dots into a very coherent picture and a coordinated view of what's going on. I wrote the book to try to connect the dots to expose the broader theme, and I hope that I was to at least a certain extent successful with that effort. The fourth motivation he put out there, political purpose. Now, I saw political purpose and I thought, okay, sharing three of Orwell's four motivations to write, that ain't bad. That's not too bad. Because I just saw political in that sort of phrase, political purpose, and I knew that I did not write The Leech for political aims. That's the last thing in the world that I was interested in. But then I read on within that essay of Orwell's, and he defined political purpose as the desire to push the world in a certain direction, to alter other people's idea of the kind of society they should strive for. Whoa, stop right there. Suddenly, not only didn't I match Orwell's roadmap 4 out of 4, okay, so 4 for 4, I'm sounding like I'm giving a George Brett or Pete Rose box score from the 1970s. But this fourth motivator of political purpose, as he defined it, was probably the biggest motivator of the four for me. Yeah, I think Orwell figured it out for writers years ago, decades ago, and exposing that sense of injustice that is the Leech Way and what it's doing to our doers in society, that was and remains my motivation to write. The plight of creators, enablers, and servers at the hands of the leech, it deserves and it desperately needs, society desperately needs to have a hearing with respect to it. Now you take those four motivations of Orwell's and how they were applicable to me and they drove me to write The Leech and create the Far Middle podcast. They were suddenly going back and tying back to what I discussed earlier with the events leading up to and after the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections. They were suddenly turbocharged and catalyzed and boosted over the past couple of years, 5 years or so. And yes, this effort of writing the book, it took years. You measured it in years. With the first couple of years, really not writing the book, but developing some of the themes and chapters in different speeches that I gave or talks that I delivered over that period of time. And then at some point, a realization of a connected theme came to light to me, and the thought of arranging those individual pieces and speeches and positions into a coordinated view really was the driver for the last couple of years in that process, which was dedicated, of course, more towards writing the actual book as you would think of writing a book. And when you have over that time, 2 presidential elections and 4 years of President Trump in the middle, I guess it's going to be an event-driven, target-rich environment for putting some of these themes to work and serving as motivation to try to coalesce some of the thoughts together in a coherent book. The 4 years of President Trump, it proved to be the perfect laboratory for many of the themes that I posited in The Leech. I did assess President Trump's tenure over those 4 years in an essay on my website, nickdeolius.com. I'd encourage you to give it a read. I broke it down and looked at it across 3 primary buckets. The first one was in the arena of regulation and policy, most of it focused on domestic, but also international. And there, I graded him very high, A+. couldn't have asked for a better set of accomplishments, decisions, and policies when it came to turning loose the economic engine that is the doers of creators, enablers, and servers. I also assessed his 4 years with respect to fiscal policy and budget. Unfortunately, there assigned a grade of an F, because when you look at the concepts of balanced budgets and not outspending what you're bringing in, and government debt and monetary policy when it comes to free money and all the issues we talked about in the prior podcast with the Federal Reserve, those things got materially worse under President Trump's 4 years, unfortunately, despite the economic engine sort of awakening. And that's a shame, because that, I think, was an opportunity to get not just the numbers in better order, but also to set the tone, getting things back to maybe the way they were as far back as President Clinton, with the idea of a balanced budget, or God forbid, budget surpluses. And then I also looked at a third category of, call it leadership, for lack of a better term, but gave a C grade on that, because in some areas he did very well, particularly with revolutionizing communication, going to things like social media, bypassing a biased press and an entrenched system of elites with respect to the media. But, you know, looking at what he did with that revolutionary set of tools that he developed, and how he went about communicating and what he was saying, or the way he said it, not very good from a leadership perspective, a bit unbecoming, to say the least. And also, you can't sort of look or assess the leadership unless you also include what happened when he was a lame duck post-election, and all the train wreck that occurred after that. It wasn't exactly the leadership that you want to see when it comes to doing what's in the best interest of the country. So an A from a policy and regulatory perspective, an F fiscally, budget-wise, with respect to numbers and finance, and then a C, but a very mixed bag of a C, ranging from really impressive in terms of revolutionizing communication and how that plays into leadership, but also some abject failures in terms of the way that you say things, or he said things, or what happened after the election. But without a doubt, going back to that first category of regulation and policy, President Trump, he was the gold standard from my perspective when it came to throwing off the anchors of the administrative state and regulation and the deep state, those tentacles that we talked about, how deep they burrow into all and any value-creating activity. And Trump, I think, those 4 years under Trump provided a test for two key issues. First being, how would creators, enablers, and servers fare with the shackles cut loose? And the second question was, how would the leech react to some legitimate pushback for the first time in a very long time? And since, frankly, it reached critical mass across the economy, how is it going to respond to that legitimate pushback? So, you know, these two questions were answered in clear fashion over 4 years of President Trump, and were answered through the next election cycle in 2020, and also being answered in the here and now. This is still playing out. On that first question about how creators, enablers, and servers would fare if the shackles were cut loose, the best way you could describe that answer would be economic boom, because that's what ensued. We had an experienced true GDP growth for the first time in a long time, not just the tepid growth that we were plagued with under the 8 years of President Obama, and frankly before him too, but true GDP growth. We experienced record low unemployment, not just for an individual demographic, but across a range of demographics. We saw business take on more risk-taking. If you look at things like capital investment, that peaked up and trended up in a way that we hadn't seen in quite some time. And you take them all together, the best way to sum it up is what people referenced as the animal spirits of the business community, the economy, the markets being awakened. And it was just an awesome thing to see and an awesome thing to feel when you realize that that was really correlating to things that were enabling creators, enablers, and servers to really be cut loose and to go achieve and create value. That second question, now, how would the leech react to legitimate pushback for the first time in a long time? The answer there was that it was immediate, it was significant, it was severe. And those that that were engaged in that effort dubbed themselves, of course, the resistance. But you saw the resistance from a whole bunch of different stakeholder groups, many of which we discussed in these podcasts and in the book. The media certainly front and center with pushback to what the policy of the Trump years was trying to effectuate. And we saw this pushback and resistance with judges and courts. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a great example on the Supreme Court. I'm a fan or was a fan of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I always sort of followed, had it as a side hobby to follow different Supreme Court justices. Maybe it's my legal background. I was always sort of fascinated with how they would adjudicate and how liberal and conservative justices would approach different issues differently and how they would write opinions and form voting blocks for different issues. It was an area of great interest to me. And RBG was someone that that I'd followed closely and was a big fan of. But I got to say that you know, she also succumbed to this issue because she got involved in a lot of political discourse that was outside the norms, I'll call it, of what Supreme Court justices would normally dabble in when it came to politics during this time. Academia was front and center in this. I'm surprised there's still an ivory tower standing within academia after 4 years of President Trump. The elite class didn't get along well with 4 years during that time period. The administrative state and bureaucrats in government, think about how many bureaucrats refused to follow the orders or the direction of their publicly elected bosses or their appointed bosses. That was not a good thing to see. Mayors and city councils in our larger urban areas, they succumbed to this resistance movement. Hollywood threw a fit along with the entire entertainment complex, big tech, and also, you know, Congress. And it's not just Democrats in Congress, it's Republicans and Democrats, because with the policy aims that we saw during that time of trying to put the people and the taxpayer first and government being there to serve the people, that really flipped on its head what had become a government first approach to many in Congress, whether it was Senate or House, Democrat or Republican. Now, I think that President Trump, like him, hate him, and again, from my perspective, not a perfect president, certainly not postulating that by any stretch of the imagination, but from a policy perspective and from a philosophy that policy was sitting on top of, a really strong 4 years. It was that policy and that president was an existential threat to the leech, and certain things aren't going to change that. The 2020 election outcome isn't going to change that. COVID and pandemic and all the disruption that it caused isn't going to change that. New storylines or revisionist history, that's not going to change it. And frankly, the president, President Trump's own poor behavior and lack of decorum, that's not going to change it either. So I think looking back at things objectively, this was a good laboratory and experiment for what happens when you let creators, enablers, and servers go achieve, and what happens when you create resistance to the leech way and what the leech is trying to effectuate, which then spurred, ironically, the resist movement. What I find interesting about looking back on the Trump years is that those attacks that you see or critiques that you see are more what I would call optical. The criticisms and the attacks of that that period of time really speak to his style, the boorish nature that he would often embrace, and you know these monikers or these labels that you see, a fascist and all those other things that are thrown out there far too often and far too loosely. I don't think, however, that those are the legitimate gripes that the critics of the Trump years or the Trump presidency are really looking to. I think that's only window dressing. I think the real source of the dislike and the disdain from those that that are anti-Trump or look at that as a dark period in American history, I think it's coming from a different place. I don't think it was the poor communications that he engaged in or the crude style of him. Or him being a threat to democracy. I don't think that's really the root issue. Instead, the root issue was his moves on policy, and specifically when it came to deregulation, the things and the aims that would favor creators, enablers, and servers, and the supporting or the elevation of individual freedoms. those were the real problems and the real stressors that were looked upon by the leech as a threat and that caused the pushback and the resistance and the resist movement. So, you know, writing the book and being motivated to publish something like that, and then doing that over a period of time where you saw the run-up of a Trump election in 2016, 4 years of his presidency, and then the lead up to the 2020 election, the outcome of the 2020 election, and then all the chaos that ensued after that, and then the first 6 months or so of the Biden presidency, you really had an interesting and in some ways an ideal laboratory to put some of these theories and themes in the book, The Leech, to work, to see how they would actually operate in the real world, real time. And it just goes back to a summation of why I wrote the book. I wrote The Leech to first help leave creators, enablers, and servers alone. You know, not even asking or advocating to support them. Just leave them alone. If we can just leave them alone as a society or government can leave them alone, they're going to do wonderful things to the benefit of all of us. I wrote it to defend the individual rights of achievers, right? This nation and its founders placed individual rights at the fore of what we were trying to establish, protect, and nurture. We've got to get back to doing those things. I wrote it to let kids that are trapped in these deficient educational systems or public schools to realize, to have a better chance of realizing their potential. These kids, because of what the Leech Way has been able to achieve with entrenched interests and special interest, it's created a public education system in big swaths of this country that don't teach our kids how to read, write, do math, science, and we're dooming them to unrealized potential if we allow that and tolerate that to continue. I wanted to write this to allow taxpayers to have government work for them and to keep more of their hard-earned value. So that needs to be flipped on its head, because right now it's the other way around. The taxpayer is nothing more than a funding means to be milked, to be bled, to benefit government, to grow government, to basically fund the administrative state. I wanted to elevate the working poor and middle class in our cities, particularly, to better pathways and not have them continue to be stuck in a failed system. You think about our urban areas, how many individuals there with awesome potential are stuck in a system or an ecosystem that just isn't doing them justice. There's quite a few of them, and finding ways to give them the opportunities to go achieve, to realize their potential, or to escape the system if they so choose, that can turn many, many lives around and make a very tangible difference. And I also wrote it to stop the ripping off, frankly, of students in higher education and retirees and public pensions. And who are they getting ripped off by? They're getting ripped off by institutions and the leaders of those institutions that are more interested in a mission far afield and counter to their fiduciary responsibilities. And a lot of it enabled and supported by cohorts in government or the media or the legal profession or elsewhere. So, you know, I wrote it with those students and those retirees in mind as well. Hey, wrapping up episode 14, which is wrapping up sort of the concluding thoughts for the book, The Leech. All I can say is thank you. I want to thank you, constant listener, for riding along on the journey so far. As Jim Morrison once famously said, this is the end, beautiful friend. But I think it's the end only sort of, because the unfortunate part of this being the end, it is the end of the Far Middle podcast covering The Leech. That's great in a way, and I'm glad we made it this far, but it's also a bit bittersweet. But it's not the end in a way, because it's a new beginning. We're going to continue on with the Far Middle podcast in even bigger and better fashion and formats, and we're going to keep discussing and tackling crucial issues that are facing the creators and the enablers and the servers and out there, and things that need to be addressed to get our society and our economy and individual rights on a better track. So thank you for participating and listening in to date, and we're going to come right back at you in the near term with another exciting topic to kick a new era and a new chapter in the Far Middle podcast off in grand style.